We are back in session. I will now call the second case on today's oral argument calendar. It's case number A22-0726, State of Minnesota versus Weston Marshall Volts. Counsel, I assume that you are familiar with our general rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. We have our time clock here conspicuously situated near the lectern. And so, counsel for appellant, you may approach in the lectern in front of us and please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin your argument.
Thank you and good morning. If it please the court, my name is Jim McGeaney. I represent appellant Weston Marshall Volts in this appeal from his conviction and sentence in the underlying Olmsted County District Court action. And may it please the court, Mr. Volts and counsel. We're here before this court to argue that the trial court made essentially four errors that require a remand and a retrial in this matter. The four errors before this court, and I appreciate this 20 minutes to argue 2 hours worth of argument. Most of my arguments have been briefed, and I stand by my briefs and I'm prepared to defend them. But essentially, we pose the four errors the district court made were in denying Mr. Volts a motion on a downward dispositional departure after essentially finding that Mr. Volts was particularly amenable to probation. That the district court erred in allowing the state's expert witnesses to use the terms sperm cell and non-sperm cell in describing what are known as fractions or the result of centrifugal analysis of substances at the BCA lab. The other error was allowing the witnesses and to testify using full face shields that prevented appellant, counsel, and the jury from seeing the witnesses' faces and demeanors during trial. And the fourth error was denying a petition for post-conviction relief based on newly discovered evidence. So I'd like to start with that fourth error, Your Honors. The victim, MS in this case, testified extensively about the events. It's outlined in my brief when asked specifically whether anything had been done to help her refresh her memory. She answered in the negative. She was asked multiple times if she was testifying from her memory. For the very first time at appellant's sentencing hearing, MS came to the hearing and made a statement to the district court, essentially saying that she had not had any memory. She'd lost her memory from the events and had undergone EMDR therapy to recover her memories. Appellant argues and argued in the post-conviction petition that that's newly discovered evidence that's not merely impeachable. Now, all the factors for new evidence on a post-conviction case are outlined in my brief. I think the critical analysis and the one that the district court made, the conclusion the district court made, was that that was merely impeachment evidence, and therefore my client had not satisfied the requirements for post-conviction relief.
Well, what do you think it was if it isn't merely impeachment evidence? I mean, if you had been, if assuming that you knew that ahead of time, you would have used it for impeachment. So what kind of evidence are you construing? I get the newly discovered evidence, but
sure.
But how does that play out?
Well, I'll concede, it certainly is impeachment evidence, especially in light of the testimony that she hadn't done anything to help her remember. But it's also material evidence as to the underlying basis for her knowledge. I'll give you a better example, maybe. So a BCA scientist testifies at trial. The substance tested positive for cocaine, and the defendant is convicted of possession of cocaine. Then the defendant learns for the first time post-trial that BCA scientist actually didn't test that substance, that another scientist had tested the substance, and that scientist was relying on what another scientist told them, not to anybody's knowledge.
I don't know if I agree with that. It sounds more objective than subjective. I mean, in terms of being producing and actually doing something versus the female in this case saying that that her memory had been enhanced. I just don't know how you get beyond impeachment.
Because it's the basis for her knowledge of the incident. What is the underlying basis for her knowledge of the facts that occurred?
There was a report. I mean, a taped report.
Certainly, but if
from 2 days after, and so the only difference is, she could have read that or listened to the tape recording and been refreshed. So we're kind of back to this impeachment.
But again, she testified that she hadn't observed, that she hadn't reviewed any of the recordings or
anything. Yeah, so that goes to impeachment, saying, hey, that's not true, because in fact, you know, apparently therapy helped you gain back memories.
Well, and again, I concede it is impeachment, but it's also material because it goes to her basis of knowledge. What is the basis?
So it's really strong impeachment. I mean, I don't mean to twist what you're saying, but you're saying it's so significant that reversal is appropriate here.
We believe so. It's not just impeachment, but it's material.
Okay, so you're saying newly discovered evidence.
Correct.
She testified. You have the ability to cross-examine her. How is this? How do you transfer this now to newly discovered evidence because she said that she was wearing blue instead of white? I mean, I'm being facetious when I say that, but I don't know how it falls under the category of something that you could not have known at the time. I mean, you had the opportunity to impeach her.
We asked her specifically about if she had done anything to help refresh her memory. She denied it. So we did cross-examine her. There's no way for appellant to have known that she was testifying from recovered memory rather than actual memory. Throughout the state's direct examination, it's outlined in our responsive brief, it's at least 6 or 7 occasions she was asked specifically about her ability to remember. Are you testifying from your memory, to the best of your memory? On cross-examination, she was asked, have you done anything to help refresh your memory? Did you talk to anybody to help you refresh your memory? And she answered in the negative to all those
questions.
But
there'd be nothing inappropriate about her having done that, right? Reviewing her prior statement.
No, absolutely not.
It's just that she didn't view it this way when she answered the question.
I don't think
that her therapy, you know, going through it in therapy helped her regain memory.
Yeah, I don't know that she was perjuring herself, in other words, by answering in the negative, because she's at trial. I mean, she's a witness in a trial. She's the complaining witness. She's nervous. We're not accusing her of anything inappropriate, but it's certainly material. What would be more material in a case where you have opposing versions of an incident than to hear that one of the versions is being offered from created memory through therapy rather than through actual memory?
Okay, now that leads to another question. You're calling it created memory. I mean, there's no basis in the record for that. And I know you did cite cases about throwing, you know, the case where this, you know, I don't even know what it's called, but recovered memory or something in the, you know, all of a sudden the Archdiocese case, the Doe case. But the burden is on appellant here. And so you didn't put in any evidence at all on what EMDR is. Correct.
We didn't get the opportunity to. Our request for hearing was summarily denied.
Right, but you could have submitted an affidavit, for example, when you requested the post-conviction.
Post-conviction statute is pretty clear that the petition is not to be there's no argument or citation to authorities with a petition. So I think it's the district court as the gatekeeper, and it's presumed that you're going to get an opportunity to do those things when you file a petition. So by summarily denying the petition, the district court denied us an opportunity to make a record as to EMD therapy or, for that matter, discovery about what, if any, maybe this witness spoke to the victim witness people about this therapy. Because we didn't know about it, we didn't attempt to make any discovery on it. So I guess the point is that it's relevant evidence when, and I apologize for recovered recovered memory is the term I meant to use. So
okay.
The heat of the moment, I used it.
But we don't know that this is what it was even. I mean, that's a supposition.
Well, from her statement.
She said gain back memories.
Correct.
It doesn't say I'd totally forgotten everything. Time
she says
passed.
I lost all memory of the assault in her statement. Those were her words in the transcript, and I guess I can.
In the transcript.
In the transcript of the sentencing hearing.
The judge quoted her as saying, "I soon lost memories from my past and evidence of the night I was assaulted." Period. That's one sentence.
I would reference the transcript. I think the transcript is clear about what she said. There's a transcript. And, in fact, there's a written version of her statement that went into the record as well. Our interpretation of her statement was
that... Did they just read the statement?
She actually got filed in the court
before
the hearing, and then she came and read it out loud into the record.
Yeah, okay.
So the document is in the court record?
Right. And I've seen that, yep.
I'd like to address another issue on appeal. My time is running short, and that is on the confrontation issue. I think the district court makes an error. It cited in respondent's brief that the factual record about the inability to see the witnesses when the district court said it was a conference at the bar about a totally different issue, and the district court made a comment that the only record being made about the witnesses' inability to be seen is this right now, and I disagree that that's the case. But if you go back and read the transcript about the bench conference, it was actually a conference held in chambers. Because this trial happened in the new COVID courtroom, and there was technology for the attorneys to wear headsets to communicate with the trial judge without the jury hearing, and it failed. So we weren't able to communicate with the trial judge without the jury overhearing us. We went into chambers, and the record is clear. Appellant's counsel told the trial judge they could not see the witness's face. Counsel for the state agreed that it was problematic seeing the witness's face, and a bailiff told the trial court judge one of the jurors says they can't see the witness's face.
Well, that's not unusual. I mean, there's many trials, and the judge says, you know, let me know if you can't see or hear. It's beyond seeing. Sometimes they can't hear because maybe there's background noise. So, I mean, that's the judge was doing what, I think it was a he, what he was would normally do as far as letting the jurors. You know, at first I read this and I thought, why are the jurors saying they can't see? And then I was reflecting on that the jurors always notify the court if they can't see or hear evidence.
Certainly, and that's problematic. That's a Sixth Amendment violation. Well, if the jury can't hear or see the evidence, then the trial judge has a duty to fix that. And the district court judge refused. He said the witness is going to wear the mask. And then they make some attempts by adjusting the masks. And the trial judge says, well, I can see fine. But the trial judge is sitting behind the witness, not in front of the witness. The witness is sit up.
After the second mask, or when there was a recess and another mask was administered, the jurors could see and hear then, correct?
No, in our opinion, no. There was no second mask. They continued to use the full face shields.
I thought there was a recess and something else was
glasses
produced.
Instead of. At least that's what it reflects in the record.
It was discussed.
A different kind of mask was used.
That was discussed, but it never was implemented. The witnesses all wore the same mask, and I believe that's in the record. What they did was they had the
shield,
witnesses.
Right? Witnesses wore
but there was a different style, I thought. One that looked was more like eyeglasses instead of...
One of the bailiffs suggested that there is another one available, but it was never implemented. The witnesses all wore the face shields. And the issue with the face shields were that in the new courtroom with the fluorescent lighting, the lighting reflected off the shields and you couldn't see you couldn't see any of the witnesses' faces.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a complaining witness. The argument arose during the complaining witness's testimony.
And it covered their eyes, is what you're saying.
The shield covered their
forehead.
Yeah, went from the forehead down to the chin.
Yeah.
And the record is clear. And in fact, the trial judge even says on the record, when it's pointed out that even the juror is having problems, can't see the witness's face, the trial court judge says, I don't doubt that, but that's not a constitutional violation, which is completely wrong. That's a Sixth Amendment violation.
Well, that's the question. And so our court decided a case called Motland. I think you're familiar with it.
I am.
And which involved face masks.
Correct.
Okay, so how is analytically... You know, why should we decide this case differently than Motland?
Certainly. And I distinguished it in my brief, but I'll do it for this court. In Motland, and by the way, the review was denied, I think. I think counsel sent you an update.
It's a final opinion now, right?
Yep. Yeah. So in Motland, it was the cloth mask that only covered the nose and the mouth. And the tops of the witnesses' heads could still be seen. And the court in Motland decided that because you could see their eyes, that was enough to satisfy the confrontation clause. In this case, and I cited a federal case, Sammons, where the federal court held that a face shield was a violation. In this case, it wasn't just a cloth mask covering the nose and the mouth that you see still today people wearing, especially now with the issues we're having from up north, but rather an entire face shield that went from the forehead to the chin and prevented you from seeing any facial expression, any eye expression. And I concentrated on
it. I didn't see it, of course, but what I'm imagining from the record we have is that obviously a face masks are usually opaque, and so you can't see through it at all. So it's completely covering, say, half the face.
Correct.
The face, I'm imagining a clear plastic shield that was shiny, had some reflection. So it potentially allowed people to see the whole face, but sometimes it was obscured by glare or reflection. But sometimes it was not, it seemed.
I think
if I accurately described.
No, I think the trial judge said he could see sometimes the face, but again, the trial judge.
Sometimes. It wasn't constant. It sounds like it depended on the position or the movement or the lights. We can finish this.
Certainly, I think the record reflects that it was constant from the front, from the witnesses facing out. It was constant to both appellant's counsel for the state, and the jurors. For the trial judge, he said he could see intermittently her face, but he has a different angle from the witness than the rest of the courtroom. The trial judge is sitting kind of to the side and behind the witness, not directly in front of the witness. And I'll address this more in rebuttal, if I may.
Well,
unless you want to fit.
Well, maybe we should wrap it up, but at least
certainly
have another question. I mean, weren't there a couple times during the proceedings where a defense counsel said that's better or that's okay or something to that effect? In other words, and I suppose I'm imagining defense counsel has a point of view that's very similar to defendant's point of view. I mean position of view.
I think the record was clear defense counsel was not wanting the witnesses to be masked, but that what the judge's decision was, well, yeah, I'm okay. That's your decision, judge. What else are we going to do other than move forward? I don't think that if it's in the record, it's not meant to concede that you could see the witness's face, but that the judge wasn't going to do anything else about it.
So can I ask one more
Yes.
question? On, so at some point, the judge says, well, the witnesses are going to be masked here. So it can either be the clear face shield or it can be the same, you know, partial, but the same kind that was found not to violate the Constitution in Motland. So did the defendant at that point, is it an invited error? Or what should we do with that?
That's a good question. First of all, Motland hadn't been decided completely yet. But at that point...
And I suppose the U.S. Supreme Court might weigh in. Okay, I'll take that back. Yeah,
You're correct. I think the defense did what they did, and it's in the record about previous trials in that quorum, was that it's more appropriate to have the witnesses remove their masks while they testify. And that was the request to the trial judge, that even that opaque mask was going to be a violation. And then the trial judge decided, I think in the record says, well, we're going to stay, we're going with these masks. With these shields is what the trial judge decided to do. Thank you. I'll reserve my 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. McGee. Counsel for respondent, you may approach the lectern. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Jim Haas. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this case. On behalf of our office, I'd like to welcome you all to Olmsted County. Glad to have you here. I'd like to pick up where we left off in the question of the confrontation and the witnesses wearing a clear plastic face shield. I want to make a couple of points. First of all, what we have here is a factual dispute here. One thing we always instruct jurors on is that the statements of counsel are not evidence. The person in the record here complaining, if you will, about the face mask was appellant's counsel. And Mr. McGeaney was not only the appellate lawyer, he's the trial lawyer in this case as well. So it was Mr. McGeaney in the record complaining of this essentially confrontation violation. On page 314 of the trial transcript, that's document 128, Mr. McGeaney makes a comment about the shield and not being able to see a witness's face. And Judge Chase literally said, I just have to jump in. I don't think there was any inability to see a witness's face. Judge Chase goes on, apparently the only factual record that's ever going to be made about that is what we say right now about it. And I'm not going along at all with the idea that there was any inability to see the witness's face in general. Was there some reflection off the face shield? Yes. Do I think it rose to the level of not being able to see a witness's face? I disagree with you on that, Mr. McGeaney, and I want to make sure that the court isn't conceding the correctness of your factual assertions. This is what I would say the fact finder stated on the record, and I would submit to you that the statements of counsel in the record are not evidence.
But the jurors did respond in terms of their ability to see.
There was comments by the juror about some intermittent glare on the clear face shield. That's true. And again, the court notes that. And they did different things with the angle of the shield and the lighting. But to suggest that the witness's demeanor was unconstitutionally diminished by this face shield, I think it's just factually inaccurate. I do want to point out the Sammons case.
Would you agree, Mr. Hazy, that when the district judge says there's not a constitutional violation, that's a legal conclusion? We don't defer to that.
That's absolutely correct. I'm just talking about the actual facts of the case. And I think the courts are familiar with these face shields. We use them broadly throughout the state of Minnesota. They have a headband of sorts, and it's a plastic shield. Maybe it would have been helpful to put one in the record. I was tempted to wear one for my argument today, frankly.
Maybe no different than plexiglass, which has also been standardized.
And in previous orders from the Minnesota Supreme Court, the Chief Justice had made reference to that. In fact, Motland, it's cited in Motland about how that may be an alternative, a lesser alternative to the face shields. But I want to talk about the Sammons case that counsel referenced. And counsel made reference to being a face shield. Sammons was not a face shield. Sammons was a case where they had a confidential, reliable informant that was testifying at a hearing outside the presence of a jury as to whether or not there could be an entrapment defense. And the state did not want the defendant to know who that person was, so they didn't disclose the name, and they wore a ski mask. It wasn't a face shield, just like, you know, the ones we wore in the 70s, you know, that covered up your nose and the whole thing. And literally, it was just like on TV.
Case from another state that's and it was from another state. Not presidential. So a question I've got is the district court judge did not make any particularized findings here. And the order from the Chief Justice did leave to the discretion of the district court judge whether there's a case-specific reason to allow somebody to take off a mask in a courtroom.
Well, the two-prong
test. What are we supposed to do with that?
Sure. The two-prong test is whether it's necessary for important public policy, and two, whether it's reliable. I submit that there is findings of fact in the record here, and they came from none other than Chief Justice Lori Gilday in the order that controlled. She stated facts that since the last, and this is an order dated October 18th of 2021, that the COVID-19 pandemic has continued. The positivity rate and positive case numbers in Minnesota have increased significantly, and the entire state of Minnesota is currently experiencing a high level of community transmission. These are facts, and they're facts found by the Minnesota Supreme Court, upon which I think our district courts can and must rely in running their courtroom. So was it necessary for Judge Chase to repeat these findings of fact that had been, you know, promulgated by the Supreme Court? I'm not so sure that's so necessary. And frankly, I don't think that's really in dispute here in the sense that I don't think appellant is disputing the necessity for face coverings. I think the real focus here is whether it rose to the level that the witness's demeanor was so diminished as to deprive Mr. Volz of his right of confrontation. So I think we're getting, there was some discussions in the Motland case about this issue of the findings. I don't get too far off track, but again, I think there were findings of fact that satisfied the necessity prong, as it did in Motlin. I guess I think we just come down to the question of facts here, that Judge Chase, who was here, could see it all, said, look, it doesn't give rise to that level. It's, in other words, it doesn't obscure their face so much that it creates an inability to see. And I think the court can defer to those findings of facts in making its legal, you know, constitutional choice on that.
Doesn't the necessity prong contemplate some case-specific reasons rather than, I mean, the Chief Justice's order was intended to be to govern all trials in the branch, but the constitutional analysis and the specifically the necessity requirement, isn't that a case-specific determination?
Well, this is a general rule, right, that could be applied to all various things. There could be a number of circumstances entirely separate from the pandemic that might require some lack of confrontation. And so, sure, there needs to be some findings, but I stand by the fact that these are the factual findings. They are specific. They do satisfy the necessity prong, and I think it's sufficient.
So there are. In other words, you're saying there are no case-specific findings necessity.
The district court said, I have to because of the pandemic. And I think that's in the record, and because we're ordered to. And I think the facts supporting that are made by the Supreme Court. I think it's a hyper-technical application of the rule to say you have to continually repeat this specific findings. In other words, there's nothing unique or necessary about this courtroom or the particular facts of this case that required. And what are fact-specific reasons? Well, typically it's an in-court identification. You know, the rule says you can remove the mask for those, you know, is that the guy? Please remove your mask, those sorts of things. But the district courts are given broad discretion for public safety to do it. I think the findings are there in the record that satisfy the necessity prong, and whether they're detailed enough for this court, I guess this will be up to you, to you all. But again, I think that these findings of fact are in the Supreme Court's order by which the district court was bound.
Am I correct that the Supreme Court in Tate, which was I think not an issue about face masks, but it was an issue, I think, about allowing, I think, Zoom testimony, mm-hmm. essentially. But didn't that case also talk about, that opinion also talk about the requirement of case-specific findings?
Well, in that case, of course, the witness, I think, had been exposed to COVID-19. And the concern was that if that person came live in court, they could transmit the disease to others in the courtroom. And that was the reason why they were allowed to testify by Zoom, because of the physical concerns of their transmission and their recent exposure. And so those were the fact-specific reasons cited there that Tate goes into, that you have to make some very fact-specific findings. Well, that was unique. But here...
I think Tate also had a discussion about alternatives. In other words, you know, could the case be continued? Could mm-hmm. we wait until this witness is healthy, and you know, other, could the state have called a different witness and so on? I thought that was, I'm speaking from memory, but I thought that was part of the court's analysis.
Well, and there was a dissent, of course, in Tate from Justice Thiessen, who mm-hmm. disagreed that it was enough of a necessity. So, yeah, I think that's the balancing test the court has to apply as to whether it's necessary for an important public policy, and that's where you apply these facts. I just don't think the public policy and the necessity is really meaningfully in dispute here in light of the Supreme Court's order. And I think the court's findings that we're required to do this because of the order, because of the pandemic, because of the risk of transmission, I think those are amply specific.
So it seems like your argument, just so I understand it, is that as long as the district court was following the four squares of the Chief Justice's order, that everybody be masked, that there were no, that covers the need for findings
yes.
of necessity. And that only if you're doing something different, like in Tate it was by Zoom, that then additional findings would be necessary. Is that a...
I would agree with you that if the court is following the order from the Supreme Court in their yeah. courtroom when it's applied, yes, I think that satisfies necessity.
Or if a juror triggered some inability to see, hear, or process. Then you'd need to have additional findings that would be remedied. Don't you agree with that? I mean, you could be following the order, and the way you're sitting or something could impact.
Certainly. I mean, the district court has to adjust the circumstances to the needs. Our position is quite simply that Judge Chase was quite adamant that this did not interfere with the juror's ability to see the witness's demeanor. In fact, I would submit that it was more enhanced than the demeanor in Motland, where the nose, mouth, they couldn't tell if what person was smiling, frowning, laughing. Here they could. And I guess I defer to the fact finding the district court, and I would ask the court to do the same.
I think it's an interesting constitutional question about what is relevant. Who must see whom? Because as I recall the Supreme Court case law, I think one significant policy concern is that the witness see the defendant. So the witness feels the gravity of the moment, understands the importance of giving truthful testimony. It's easier for a person to tell falsehoods when they don't see the defendant who's affected by that. Does it matter whether the jurors can see the witness? Or does it matter whether the defendant can see the witness, or does it matter whether the witness can see others? I assume there's no record of any difficulty the witness had in seeing out from the shield.
I'm unaware of any inability in the record of the witness to see out of the shield.
Right. Okay, but as a legal matter, which viewpoints are relevant to this analysis?
I think the defendant, needs to confront their accuser, needs to be able to see the witness. I think the jurors do. I think all those points are correct. I think it's all part of the confrontation process. If that answers the court's question, it's not just the jurors, in other words. I agree.
I'm not sure if there is a clear answer, but it's an interesting question.
Yeah. In the time I have left, I wanted to just touch on the other topic that you discussed with counsel about this post-conviction issue, newly discovered evidence. I want to point out that there's nothing in the record here to show when this therapy occurred and whether it occurred after the witness testified at the trial and prior to sentencing or whether it occurred. So right off the bat, there's some speculative nature about this. The district court dropped a footnote about that in the post-conviction order and just said, for the sake of argument, I'm going to assume that the therapy occurred prior to trial. I also would point out that there's just no evidence in the record to suggest that these witnesses' memory was somehow reconstituted or enhanced or altered in any way by this sort of therapy. Remember, we're talking a span of years has gone by here.
Well, she said that as a result of therapy, this has helped me, get back memories of the assault.
Yep, this has helped me be able to cope with the trauma of the assault and help me gain back memories of the assault.
So isn't that evidence that there was some, recovery?
A lot.
I don't know, but to what extent, and is it, I'd forgotten about that little aspect of things, but is it, material aspects of consent, which was really the central issue here? Well, I guess all I'm pointing out is, the record is pretty scant with any particular evidence of what exactly.
We're lacking a factual record because there was no evidentiary hearing. A petitioner was not allowed an evidentiary hearing. So the question, it seems, is whether, as it was pleaded in the post-conviction petition, whether the allegations in the petition would state a claim for relief, and if so, if we assume the facts to be true. So, why, given the allegations, why is no evidentiary hearing required?
Well, in short, I think no matter how you slice it, I agree with the district court that this would be offered for impeachment. Maybe very important impeachment.
And only impeachment, mere impeachment, in other words. Nothing more than impeachment is what you're saying.
Yes, because it's not material evidence regarding a substantive element or fact. It is to degrade the credibility of the complainant. With that, I just respectfully ask you to affirm the conviction, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hasse. Mr. McGeaney, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. Briefly, I want to start. This is rebuttal. So counsel says the factual record, it was clear that the district court was adamant that there was no question about whether the witnesses' faces could be seen. I point this court to the trial transcript, page 105, when the discussion was being had and the bailiff told the court that a juror couldn't see the witness. The judge said, I don't doubt that to be the case. The trial court admitted that a juror couldn't see the witness. I don't doubt that to be the case. That's the factual record as well. So despite the trial court statements later at another bench conference, the trial court already acknowledged that it had been told and didn't doubt that the at least one juror couldn't see the witness's face, that particular witness being the complaining witness. Regarding the necessity prong, as Judge Johnson addressed with the respondent, we do not concede that the necessity prong has been satisfied. We argued it in our brief, and I'll say it today, and I think the court's right on point. The order from the Supreme Court the counsel relies on as fact-specific, case-specific facts to justify wearing of the mask goes on to say, the presiding judge has the discretion to permit individuals to remove a face covering during an in-person proceeding for case-specific reasons. What more case-specific reason could there be than assertions from attorneys for both parties and a juror that they can't see the witness? There is no better case-specific reason. But that's not what the requirements are. The requirements from Craig are that the district court make case-specific findings on why it's going to require the masks. And they're not here. And it's clear in Craig that generalized COVID concerns, I want to cite the case, and the Minnesota Supreme Court has adopted that test. Generalized COVID concerns do not satisfy the denial of a Sixth Amendment confrontation right, and that's what happened here. The trial court said we're going to do it because of COVID. No other case-specific reason.
So what impact did the Chief Justice's order have then?
Well, I think, for instance, all the jurors had to wear masks. All the court staff had to wear masks. Counsel had to wear masks. All the people in the galley had to wear masks.
My question is, are we supposed to just disregard the Chief Justice order? Is that what you're saying? As a reviewing court, because it wasn't, I don't know, read into the record or reflected in the record?
No, but I think that the Chief Justice's order does not trump the Confrontation Clause. And if there's an issue with a Sixth Amendment confrontation, that trumps the Supreme Court's order. And there's a provision in the order for it. The district judge has discretion to permit removal of masks for case-specific reasons.
So just so as our appeal analysis is concerned, you're not saying that we can't acknowledge that Chief Justice order was in place.
I think you can acknowledge it in place, but that doesn't satisfy that order. Counsel's relying on that order for the case-specific reason for requiring masks. I think case-specific means the case at bar, not some generalized order that covers the entire state of Minnesota.
So as long as you're not arguing that the judge had to make an actual statement on the record at some point that this was required or reference it or something, you're not making that claim.
No, I'm saying that the trial judge had to make some findings about the case that was in front of him as to why, after being confronted with the fact that people can't see this witness's face, why he was going to continue to have the witness wear a face shield, a full face shield. And the trial judge erred when said this isn't a constitutional problem. It certainly was. I'm almost out of time. I want to address a couple of things quickly. So Tate is the case that requires case-specific findings and that the generalized concern is not sufficient. And so the necessity prong is not satisfied. And the analysis should end there. The cases should be remanded just for that. We didn't discuss the other two issues. I'll leave the departure issue. I don't have time for that. But I want to just touch on the sperm cell fraction piece. I can't find a case that's been argued to this court about that term, and yet that term's been used for years and years and years by BCA analysis. How could it not be confusing and misleading? I think you even read the judge's order, Judge Chase's pretrial order. When you're saying the defendant's DNA was found in the sperm cell fraction of that analysis, Who's not going to conclude that that DNA came out of a sperm cell when it's clear that it's possible that the DNA that comes out of the sperm cell fraction could have come from an epithelial cell and not a sperm cell? And it's, and I'm out of time, if I could just finish my thought.
Please do.
The BCA expert at the omnibus hearing testified it's just a term. It's just the term we use. If it's just a term, why use that term?
But you made it, you did a great job at trial, though, clarifying the term.
I don't know. If you read the transcript about that, but that analysis testimony when I was trying to clarify where the DNA came from, he wouldn't give it to us. The state's witness compounded the issue because when asked directly, isn't it true you can't say what kind of cell that DNA came out of? He said, well, if the sperm cell's in there, it came from a sperm cell. He wouldn't have acknowledged that that DNA could have come from a different kind of cell. So that even compounded and confused the jurors more. If it's just a term, why not use another term? I know I'm out of time, and I appreciate this court allowing me to go over a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGeaney. Thank you to both attorneys for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will now court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.